Hello, welcome to the At YouTube Podcast, episode number 45, where we talk all things YouTube, album news, tour dates, community discussions from the staff of At YouTube. Welcome to our pop-sode, whatever. Let's bring on some guests. Popcast. Yeah, there we go. Bring on some folks to help rescue me from my own dumb puns here, because it's later than usual when we record, and so we might be a little punchy, a little poppy tonight. So first up in the list is Sherry. Welcome back, Sherry.
Boom cha, y'all.
And Marilyn.
Howdy.
And Ian.
Hello.
And you all failed, except for Sherry, once again, the memo that I didn't send about having a pop-related or album-related, what would that be, catchphrase or introduction phrase or something when I introduce you. And Becky will be joining us at some point later in the show when she gets here or there, whatever. So before we, just to stop the emails, we are going to do a Passengers episode, but it's not going to be, we're going to stay with the traditional albums for now, and we will do Passengers, extras, B-sides, all sorts of other stuff eventually. But so we thought we'd, I guess I did. I didn't even actually ask the committee, the podcast committee. I just made up a rule that we're going to do the official albums first, and then we'll settle everything else after that if no new album has dropped by then.
That's putting some pressure on.
We'll see.
Larry, do you want us to talk about Passengers? Really?
There you go. So you know what we're going to do this time is we're all the Ask At YouTube questions. So you can normally you can send in questions through Twitter and comments and stuff for the show if you use hashtag Ask At YouTube on Twitter. And but this time all the questions and comments were related to either songs or the whole album and stuff like that. So we're going to just jump right into the roundtable discussion and skip all the preamble that we normally do. So might only be a 2-hour episode tonight instead of the usual 4 or 6 hours, whatever we are. So I got a memo from Matt. So I'm just kidding. We didn't really get any memos. We don't have memos. We just have Slack. But so if you're just joining us, if this is your first episode because you love pop and hate everything else by YouTube, welcome here. First of all, we're doing an album by album discussion. We started back on episode 34, 10 episodes ago. So if you go to goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34, that'll be where Boy starts off and you can follow along as we go. So we're up to pop. So anybody have any thoughts on just where YouTube was at when pop was released? It was the mid-90s, late-90s, I guess, depending on how you look at it. At Mysterious Days had commented songs like Please Wake Up, Dead Man Gone, etc. suggest such a dismalness. Was the band in a state of despair? If Berlin inspired Uptown Baby, do you think Miami inspired pop? So were they actually in Miami for the whole recording, or was it kind of like part of the... That's sort of where they landed for a bit of the recording, kind of how the album sort of record elsewhere, and then they end up doing the final stuff in Dublin back home. Anybody know?
Couldn't tell you.
They were all over the place. They were in Dublin for a period of time. They were in Miami for a period of time. They were also down in Cuba. That's where some of the photos from the pop photo shoot took place. But they were really disjointed with the recording of it. They were bouncing back and forth between Howie B and Flood, and they kept asking for an extension, because the album just never felt finished. And so when the record label guy would show up at the studio, and Matt has a really good interview with Mark Moreau where he goes into it, and we'll put the link into the show notes. The band just was not ready to release this album. As legend has it, they booked the Pop Mart tour prior to the album being finished, which was the worst thing that could have ever happened. And I believe next to Passengers, Larry said that that's probably the worst decision they've ever made. So it put them in a bit of a pickle that here they are releasing the album at the same time as them announcing a tour. I mean, the album came out March 2nd or 3rd. The tour was announced on, of all things, Ash Wednesday at a Kmart in Midtown New York City in the women's lingerie section of all places,
naturally,
which they thought was kind of tongue in cheek, but nobody got the joke. And so from that point on, the tour announcement came before the album came out. And then you also had the discotheque video that was not a very U2-y kind of thing. And people were really confused about the band. So I think the band was confused. We all were confused. Media certainly didn't get it. And so thus began the legend of pop, which we'll get into in a little bit.
This is where Larry had some, I mean, he's had back issues, but like, wasn't he gone for a while or something? He was injured or had to get surgery or something anyways. And so I don't know, maybe this is urban legend and probably is a lot of it is urban legend, but you know, where he's gone. And so then they bring in electronic dudes and dudettes or whatever, who are helping, you know, fill in the gaps so they can, you know, using remixes or using loops and stuff like that more.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, I could understand Larry coming back and being like, what the Larry is like, going
do
on?
Do I still have a job here? This is my band after all.
Yeah.
So I think that added to a little bit of the tension as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I know. I remember, and you guys can jump in here too, when sort of seeing the discotheque video and being with friends over and finding on the web or something, or maybe on, they're going to preview it in Canada here, like Much Music, but, and watching it with friends, be like, oh, the new YouTube single or video or whatever. And like, and everybody in the room just came kind of being like, okay, I don't know what to do with this. Just like you said, it was kind of like, I dug the music for sure. And it was just kind of fun. But then the video was like, okay, this is like over the top, kind of making fun of themselves or the industry or whatever. And yeah, just like you said, you kind of didn't know what to make of it and how to sort of, in a sense, justify you two to your friends at that moment anyways, for me. But maybe Marilyn, how about you? Do you remember when the album was released and sort of what your initial thoughts were going into it?
I actually don't remember when the album was released. I didn't come to pop until 2001. So I know I'm a great U2 fan, right? Fan of the year. I had gone back to work after I had my son in 2001. It was right after 9/11. It was a week later. And somebody at work had a mixtape of U2 songs. And, you know, I was a casual fan. I went to all the shows because I knew they always put on a good show. And I think All That You Can't Leave Behind just came out. And there were some songs, there was a bunch of songs from that CD on there, on that mixtape, and there were a bunch of songs from pop, and I didn't know the songs. And I was like, what? There's U2 songs that I don't know? Where have I been? So it took me a couple years to find pop, but then once I did, so I didn't hear of any of that.
Right.
I didn't know anything about the tour, all the issues they had, all the scheduling of the tour before the album came out. I didn't know any of that. I just, I found the album and then I started listening to it and I was like, oh my God, where has this been all my life? This is my album.
Nice.
So
that is a blissful way to experience pop.
Yeah.
It was. Any of the baggage. And it was just like, you know, I heard, I think on the mixtape was Please, and If God Will Send His Angels, and maybe one or two other ones. And I was just like, where has this album been all my life? I love this album. It's just, so yeah, I missed all of that. I mean, I did go to the Pop Mart tour, and the only thing I can say about that is our tickets, it was in a stadium, and our tickets were in the uppermost levels, but they didn't sell all the tickets, so they pushed everybody down. We ended up on the second level or something. So, you know, yeah. I'm sure all the people who paid for the second level seats were very angry at the people from the top level coming down and sitting next to them while, you know, they paid more money for their tickets. But
yeah,
but otherwise, yeah, I didn't know any of that, any of those stories until much later.
How about you, Ian? What was your, where did you come at pop?
Well, one of the things I'd add just to the recording story is, if I remember correctly, after Adam missed that show on the Zoo TV tour and decided to go sober, one of the things he did while he was working on his sobriety was go to a bass instructor in New York. And so this was the first album they released after he had like finished, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, technically learning how to play the bass.
Right.
And I mean, on songs like Mofo and Last Night on Earth and If You Wear That Velvet Dress, his just increased talent just within that short space of time is just so clear and so impressive. And it's one of the best things I think about the album. For me, this was actually the album that got me into U2. I remember very clearly the night that I first heard Discotheque, and just from the very start of it, I was just listening there with my jaw open, like, what the heck is this? And it's still so clear to me listening to the song. And it was back when radio was still a thing. So I immediately called into the radio station. What the heck was that? What was that? And they said, that's the new U2. And so as soon as it came out on single, I bought the single. And I remember buying the album. It was the first time I'd ever bought an album the day of when its release. And I remember just listening to it pretty much nonstop for 3 days, just nice. Again and again and again. Just this was the album that convinced me that U2 was the band for me.
So there you go. To all the people who, I forget who it was, there's a couple of people who tweeted, like, are there actually enough people who like pop to have a podcast about it or whatever is what they were, you know, that kind of.
That's blasphemy.
I know, that's what I'm just saying. Here are, in the flesh, they do exist. And I count myself one of them as somebody who definitely likes pop. Not all of it, but definitely likes pop. There are people who do enjoy it. I remember hearing that too somehow about Adam. I think Larry too, taking like drum
Larry
lessons.
Was up in Boston.
Yeah. And just like it kind of blew me away. And obviously musicians do this all the time, but just the idea that here's a successful band and the instrumentalists are going to take lessons again. And how would somebody approach that? Like here's, you know, as a teacher or whatever. And obviously there's lots they can learn and stuff. But I just remember at the time thinking like, oh, wow, that's so crazy that they'd be taking lessons. I'm sure Bono went in for lots of lessons and songwriting training as well.
he had voice lessons from Chrissy Hynde, didn't he?
Right.
Round Unforgettable Fire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
Pop was the first album that I did a launch party for that was for the Boston area fans to begin with. And we did it at the Paradise. We were lucky enough to have Carter Allen come out for it. And there were about 300 of us all doing the pop launch a couple days before the album actually hit stores. So that was my first foray into it, was actually helping promote the album.
Oh, nice. That's fun. Fun way to, so you got to actually hear it before the whole album was released anyways, which is pretty cool. All right. The one comment, where is it here? At This Train 9900 said, any thoughts on why Holy Joe was never performed live after the Kmart press conference? Because famously they performed that song as part of the press conference. I personally really loved the song. It was a then B-side on, is it Discotheque or I think. And I really liked it. It doesn't sound like it's a fully fleshed out song. Maybe that's why they never actually went too far with it or whatever, but any thoughts on why they would have done it there and then just kind of dropped it away?
The performance was so bad. I mean, if you listen to it, it just sounds awful.
It was all reverb.
Yeah. Yeah. It just sounds atrocious.
Yeah.
I think it's because they didn't know how to play any of the other songs.
Mm-hmm. It's possible.
Yeah. but they would have had that at that time at the press conference anyways, they would have had the album track listing settled, right? Like it was, or am I
maybe not.
The press conference was what was it, February 12th? Album came out March 3rd. So depending on where things were in the production line, it's still questionable.
Yeah, in Rolling Stone has their list of 20 insanely great U2 songs only hardcore fans should know. Holy Joe is listed as number 5. And the description of it kind of, I guess, sums it up. It says, when U2 announced their ill-fated Pop Mart tour at the lingerie department of Kmart in downtown New York, they could have serenaded the press with any songs from their vast catalog. But for some reason, they opted for Holy Joe, the B-side of Discotheque. Pop is nowhere near as bad as the legend suggests, and it would have been even better had they included Holy Joe instead of Miami or the Playboy Mansion. We'll get into that later. They haven't even played a note of Holy Joe in concert since that press conference.
So. I think it's because they were in front of all the media and they were just saying, come on, come on, be good to me.
Right. Just kind of going off the literal lyric. Nothing. Yeah, just right on top of it. But
I don't know. Like, for me, the Edge's bridge, the guitar in that just sounds so much like even better than the Real Things bridge. Yeah. For me, it just, the song sounds pretty derivative. It doesn't sound like that original for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got had a few comments from some listeners just about the album as a whole that we'll just read off a couple of them here, and then we'll get into the song-by-song discussion of the of Pop. But at Matt McGee, frequent caller into the show. We haven't answered his call tonight, I guess. But if U2 had stuck with Pop songs more in their live shows, would the album have eventually become more loved by fans? Which is an interesting theory because, you know, famously, at least for me anyways, it's often through the live versions of songs that I hear, I start to really fall in love with them. And as they, you know, obviously keep it in their catalog, on their live show catalog, more fans find it if they didn't hear it in the first place. But what do you think? Is there a reason why Pop is kind of the, I mean, we talked about some of the reasons or difficulties they had recording it, but is that why the album then is kind of looked upon lesser, I guess, by some fans, do you think?
I have a theory about Pop and the way that people react to it. I think there's a lot of revisionist history going on with the way people think of this album because of the tour and because of the disaster of the tour and the disaster of that Kmart appearance and the show in Las Vegas, which I guess some of you guys were at. Sherry, you were at that show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I thought especially when they were touring around with the Claw for the 360 tour, I thought the Pop songs would have been just absolutely perfect for that stage setup because it was a big stage and these are big rock songs. And I thought that was a missed opportunity. And I do think that if they played these songs more in concert, people would have a better feeling about the album, this late in the game. So I'm always sorry that they don't play anything from Pop. We usually get a little snippet here and there. You know, they'll throw something in. That 360 stage, I thought that was the perfect vehicle for, you know, Gone or any of those big hard rock songs. And they missed it. Such a good opportunity.
Yeah.
And I would be curious if Matt was talking about tours in general or if they played more of the Pop songs during the Pop Mart tour.
Kind of go, yeah.
Because for Pop Mart, the band struggled with certain songs. I mean, Do You Feel Loved was dropped after the seventh show. They struggled with Staring at the Sun because they couldn't replicate what it was like in the studio. So they tried it three different ways out on the B stage. None of them worked, in my opinion, except for acoustic. But when they ever tried doing it with the bongos, it was just wrong on so many different levels. That because the album, at least in North America, wasn't being played on radio to the extent that it should have, the first leg of the Pop Mart tour sold based on it just being U2. Then when it came back to North America for that third leg, they really struggled with selling tickets to the point where there were shows down in Florida where they were in stadiums with 60,000 seats, but only 20,000 people showed up. And I think Edge said, I forget if it was Tampa or Miami during the karaoke, How's the crickets back there, or something along those lines, because the stadium was just so empty. I think that they could fold in more of the pop songs after from the Elevation tour on, but I think there's a part of this album that the band would just like to forget about. I am hopeful that Mofo will make its way back into this set in one way, shape, and form. And when we get into some of the other song by song stuff, there are elements that could work. But I just think that pop is an album you either love or you hate. There is no in between.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably just a lot of the, just like technical musically or whatever, technically difficult to reproduce because of so much else that was going on, and they hadn't quite sort of grappled with how to reproduce that electronically and whether they wanted to bring people on tour with them exactly as they do now and playing under the stage and stuff like that, which I guess they did a bit of a Zoo TV, but yeah, there's a funny comment from @JJ Wabiker. He says, "I'm a huge defender of pop." He has an article that he links to, an open letter to Bono regarding the underrated gem pop, which he says, "Dear Bono, I know you're still embarrassed about getting stuck inside that giant lemon," and goes on, and we'll link to it in the show.
Good
notes.
Old Oslo.
And which is their kind of own, every band has to have their Spinal Tap moment, and they got theirs. So, he says, "We know it's underrated, but maybe also as relevant as ever." @Sharoff's mentioned, "I love the pop album, so sexy and emotional." Bono's @Bono's chest hair asked, "Why is there no chest hair in pop?" That's something
because
we ask.
Because in Miami, they wax, baby.
Yeah, we ask ourselves every day. Go ahead.
If you look at the pictures of Edge in the CD booklet, there's plenty of chest
hair. I was going to say, yeah, it is Bono's
but this
chest
is Bono's
hair.
Bono's
yeah.
hair.
It's a fair question from Bono's chest hair, but yeah.
I'm sure Edge would be willing to share his hair.
Yeah, so at Edge's chest hair, if you're out there, then you can weigh in on this. @U2 War 40, almost all the single versions off this album are superior. The exception is Staring at the Sun. No album U2's canon shows more diversity than pop. Bravo. And @RVH95, "I remember when pop was released. It was so radical, I felt angry that U2 was taking advantage of my fandom. How wrong I was." So, yeah, it definitely is an album, like you said, Sherry, that you kind of love or hate, and then there's even a bit of love and hate as we go song by song, even, I think. So, which we'll jump into right now. And it was great to actually get lots of comments from people on specific songs, which if you, in future discussions like this, if you want to do that, that's great. And we'll kind of just incorporate them into our discussion as we go song by song. So first up, of course, famously or infamously, is Discotheque. I hope that that's actually Adam's bass, like that when the music drops, but there's just the bass line there, which is, it's not too complicated, but I sometimes wonder if it actually is Adam or if it's just like, you know, it could be the producer doing a quick thing there that Adam actually didn't technically record or whatever, but I just love the feel of it. I remember I remember driving my parents' car because they had a better stereo and putting that song on and just really loving the dynamics from quiet to loud. @Fabatini said, "I have to say that I was a little bit shocked when I watched the video of Discotheque for the first time, and you, and like we said earlier, definitely there was a bit of confusion about the song and the video in particular and where it all sort of landed." The theoretical is, if they hadn't put out a video like that, you just heard the song, and maybe this is Marilyn's experience, I guess, coming backwards to it sort of, do you think it would have been caused the same kind of confusion over what is U2 doing just hearing Discotheque, or is it still the boom chuzz that would kind of like throw you off, Sherry? What do you think?
I don't think Discotheque should have been the first single off of this album.
Yeah.
And the video is so ingrained. They even played off the video in concert when they came out onto the B stage and launched the encore with it live. It's got a catchy beat. You know that they were still very much into the club culture at that point. there are several remixes of the album, version of this song. There are several remixed videos of it that were designed for the video systems within clubs. It didn't sound anything like U2, which is their signature trademark, I suppose. But I just think that the video shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah,
or vice versa.
Yeah, I honestly, I couldn't agree. I couldn't disagree more. Sorry. This was the song that got me into U2. This was the song that convinced me that, like I said earlier, U2 were the band to follow. U2 were the band that talked to me. Looking at the videos for like Even Better Than the Real Thing and Lemon and Numb, I've always wondered how people were kind of shocked by the discotheque video and how like disco-y and kitschy it was, just because, I mean, for me, it just seems like it's a very clear progression from what the videos they were doing on Octoon Baby up through this. And yeah, I don't have enough words for how much I love this song. It's what convinced me to be a U2 fan.
Nice. That's good to hear, like the counterpoint. And that's why I love doing this series that we're doing, because you kind of just, you know, you live in your little YouTube bubble, or big YouTube bubble as the case may be, depending on where.
Or Bono's bubble pants.
Yeah, or Bono's bubble pants, as someone in the chat room had asked about. Is this day, this when Bono wore bubble wrap?
yes.
It is, definitely is. But yeah, you it's good to sort of get outside your bubble wrap pants every so often and see.
Well, it's also interesting though too, because if you're thinking about Zooropa being a very European sounding album with a lot of European themes, when you have discotheque leading off the next album and it's the first single off this next album, I don't know how many discotheques there are in the States. It seemed to me to be that continued tie-in with the European side of things. But yet they were focusing their energy and their efforts on North America for the promotion of the album. So once again, I think that's where that disconnect came.
Yeah, it is an interesting point, just because of you wonder if they had launched the tour, let's say, or whatever in Europe instead of in the US, which, yeah, how things might have gone over differently and things like that. So. All right, anyways, we've got to keep moving. Do You Feel Loved is the next track.
So one of the things that I've heard a lot about U2 albums, the really good ones, is that they always have a really killer 1-2-3 start at the beginning of the album. And for me, the start of Discotheque, Do You Feel Loved, Mofo, is about as tight as U2 have ever been. Just it takes the energy of Discotheque, but it's smoother and sleeker. And one of the things that the songs that made me like really pay attention to how Bono used lyrics and how they used titles and phrasing. Cause I remember reading it, I think it was in Propaganda, him talking about how they gave the song a title that was a question, but they made it a statement because it doesn't have a question mark at the end. So Do You Feel Loved is not a question. It is like, it's a declaration of the song, and it's not curious about whether the recipient is feeling love. It's more of like it's a command. And yeah, I think this is the perfect tie-in between Discotheque and Mofo.
I agree with Ian about the first three songs on this album and how they're just really, it's like getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
But in a really good way, like that whole boxer Bono thing that he did, you know, coming into the arenas and, you know, for the Pop Mart tour. I thought that was really a good visual for how this album feels. It's very aggressive. It's really like Ian said, it's, I think Bono's writing, starting with Achtung Baby, he went inward, and this album is probably their darkest. And I think this album is everything that they do to the nth degree. It's like the funkiest, it's the rockiest, it's the darkest, it's the most, it has the most joy in it, but it's everything all the time. And the first three songs, I think, are just amazing. And this song, I love this song. And that little bit that you just played, that's my favorite part.
Oh, nice. That was a happy accident. Yeah, there's a lot of swagger to this, the first three for sure. And I do wonder, like, the live component, not when it doesn't, at least for my view, and it sounds like Sherry's view anyways too, the live component didn't pull it off quite as well, or have quite as, like, I wonder, you know, going, like, somehow you see U2 do, without the Lemon obviously, but, you know, do this set in a club, like an actual club, an actual discotheque or something like that, where it's like sweaty, hot, and the bass is just like hitting you in the face and stuff. You know, like my usual weekend, just out of the discotheque that I do. But the, you know, you wonder how that, like, that feeling to me would be a sweet way to hear pop in a sense, and see U2 perform pop in that, like, smaller setting, in a sense, even though it's like a, there's definitely big moments in the album. But anyways, I'm getting ahead of myself, and we'll keep the dance club vibe going here a bit with Mofo. I forgot to fade that one out. Looks like it's just going to keep going, which I know normally wouldn't be a problem, other than we just don't want to get sued. That's the.
I was busy dancing to it, yeah. So I was cool with it.
Well, I have to concur that that is one heavy mother effing song. There is so much to unpack in it, and that is my second favorite U2 song of all time. There's anger, there's despair, there's every single emotion is compacted into this fireball of a track. And you know, you think about the songs that Bono wrote about his mother, and this one is just full on anger about, you know, going from "Do you feel loved," which I can understand, you know, isn't a question, but you're looking to fill that God-shaped hole. You're looking to fill that part of yourself that got ripped out of you when your mother died, when you were such a tender age. And so, you know, you've got so many lyrics in there about searching, about, you know, nobody tells me no. He needs direction in his life. He needs somebody to control, you know, or to teach him. And I see this as a track where Bono might be noticing that I'm spiraling out of control. I'm searching, you know, I'm looking into religion. I'm looking at this, I'm looking at that. And the only thing that is filling me right now is that mother sucking rock and roll. It was a power punch to kick off the tour. And it's a song I can never get sick of.
Okay, you referenced that. I just have to ask, put the question out there. Do you think, was he, because I know this was discussed when the song was came out and stuff, but putting mother sucking rock and roll instead of the obvious choice of mother effing rock and roll, was he deliberate? Was he wimping out on having a swear in a song? Or
I just thought he was sucking at the teat of rock and roll.
Well, when you, I think it's like the second or the third chorus, he actually, I mean, you can hear him say mother F and rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's, for me, it's kind of like a buildup. Like,
right.
I mean, in the first couple of verses, he's saying it out loud, mother sucking. And then by the time he actually gets to it, he's just like muttering it through like clenched teeth. It's, yeah, I can't talk enough about how much I love this song. It's like after Lemon, this is the song that I want to hear the most live. I remember like at the Vancouver show, the start of the Innocence and Experience tour, when he was launching into Iris and they just did that mother. He starts singing mother, am I still your son? And I just about squealed. It was so, so amazing. The other thing that really, really, I mean, this is one of my top 10 U2 songs ever, and I will never, ever get tired of it. But the thing that blows my mind about it is how such an amazing, amazing song prompted so many just awful, awful remixes. It's a paradox. I don't understand it.
That's funny. I was thinking actually when Sherry was talking too about the idea of like, and I'm sure somebody's done this already, but putting a Marilyn mentioned, I think, mixtape, but like putting a mixtape together of all the songs where Bono's referencing, you know, fairly directly or almost, you know, a little bit indirectly his mother, and what that album of sorts would actually sound like. Cause yeah, it's not every song obviously, but there are enough that you can make an interesting album out of that. But yeah, the remix is on this one. I remember this was a stage for me where I was just like devouring U2 as a whole and like thinking everything was great and fighting anybody who'd argue about pop or whatever, even though in hindsight now I think I was maybe had my lemon up my butt a little bit or whatever. But,
but had a bit
wow,
of a pucker
that's
going.
A visual.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, with Mofo, you had Dennis Hopper announcing U2 at this as right. They launched into the song for the MTV European Video Music Awards, and he didn't hold back with the swear on that one. We got it bleeped out here in North America. But going back to the mother effing, had he done that and gotten a parental advisory sticker on the album, it probably would have sold more because it had the parental advisory on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, F up the mainstream a little bit. All right, let's keep moving on. Show me the score. Then they put Jesus in show business. Now it's hard to get in the door. It's the stuff of country songs that I guess.
Talking about transitions, like again from Discotheque to Do You Feel Love to Mofo, going from Mofo to this, where the previous song is just like this bulldozer just trashing everything, and then you come to this song that's just this beautiful crystalline fragile structure. I just love the transitions in this album. This is probably like the clearest example of how much better the single versions of the songs were than the album versions, where they moved the bridge a little later in the song and they changed the ending up. And what they ended up with in the single version is truly one of the most beautiful songs U2 has ever done. They did a phenomenal video with it.
Yes.
And it just... they filmed it in a diner in Las Vegas, and it's just all these people all sped up coming in and talking to Bono, and he's obviously not listening to them and they're not listening to him, including when the band shows up and sits in his booth. And then to top it off, they didn't play it much on the Pop Mart tour, but the first time they played it, they started off with just this quiet, just guitar bit from The Edge and Bono singing over it. And then when they launch into the song itself, it's just this beautiful, shimmering, like gorgeous piece of work. And I think it's unfortunate they could never quite figure out how to make it work, because just the bare bones of what they had at that first Las Vegas show, just, I still listen to it. It just sounds so beautiful to me.
This was the one song that got me through 9/11. Because, you know, when the Cartoon Network turns into the news, every single station was broadcasting news about the tragedy. And the only station that I could even fathom putting on was Cartoon Network, just to get away from it. You know, does love light up your Christmas tree? All of those different things. And just thinking, you know, the call out to say, God, where are you? Where are your angels? Where is everything? Why are we in this predicament? And so, you know, that was four years later. I love how you phrased it as being a crystalline song. It's the perfect, paradox to the first three songs.
Yeah, it was actually, for me, the memory of it is actually buying the single version. I found the single in Dublin because I happened to be there, and that's when it happened to come out, and buying it there and bringing it home and stuff and listening to it for the first time. And I forget where, some hostel or something that I was in, and just feeling like this cool connection to, you know, the band, obviously, and being in Dublin. And I don't think they were there at the time or anything like that. I wasn't savvy enough to start stalking them seriously at that point, but being aware of that, I was in this place where they potentially had made this music and hearing it and the single version too, like you said, Ian. I think it's probably, I don't quote me on this, but it's on a podcast, so I guess you can, that I think it's the best like bridge back into whatever chorus or verse, wherever they go, in a song that U2 has done, at least for me emotionally, whether musically is, you know, up for debate, but, just the way the build back into the song and stuff is awesome. And, yeah, something I don't think they've replicated since, but, let's keep, man, I could just, Marilyn, we haven't heard from you, but do you have,
well, I was just going to say, I think this song, the placement on the album is a necessary deep breath,
yeah,
from those first three songs. And, every good DJ knows when to slow things down so that people don't drop over while they're dancing. So, yeah.
All right. Next up was Staring at the Sun.
This is one heavy song as well, because it sounds very lighthearted, kind of like a Wild Honey type of a vibe. But you start off the song about, you know, we're just you know, stretching on the grass and, you know, stuck together with God's glue. That's a very clever way of describing whatever you're doing in the grass type of deal. And then you end the song with about intransigence is all around and military's still in town. All of a sudden you've got the innocence of a summer day being stripped away into, you know, this political situation. And within the album, that transition into that Heart of Darkness section of the album, it kind of startles you a little bit. At first, you think it's a nice poppy little song, but once you get towards the end of it, you just want to go back to what it was before. You know, I'd rather go blind. I don't want to see what's coming up ahead.
It's also probably the only pop rock song with intransigence in it as a lyric. I don't know if that's
well, I remember Bono saying in an interview that the song was about the siege on Sarajevo and how Western Europe just wanted to ignore it and just wanted to just do what they were doing, and the intransigence referred to both sides refusing to cooperate and refusing to find compromise. And yeah, it's one of the things I love about U2, where they can take this catchy, I mean, seemingly kind of kitschy song and it's about the most deadly, heavy stuff you can imagine, and they still can play both sides of the table. They can make it work both ways. I love them for it.
And I love the live version of this song. When it's just Edge and Bono singing by themselves, just the acoustic B-stage version. I think that lends to the heaviness of it.
Yeah, there's a quote from this site at U2.com that they have from Edge back in 2006, you know, from U2 by U2, just to say, Staring at the Sun was another great tune that never became a great record for whatever reason. I don't know why we didn't quite nail it in the end. When we were playing it live, we just sang with acoustic guitars and the song came through much better. And kind of like what Ian said too, where it's like you can see people who aren't paying attention to lyrics maybe just sort of thinking it's, and Sherry said this too, of like just a fun, easy, light, acoustic-y pop song thing, and but still has that depth to it that is there for the person who goes looking a little deeper. So,
and it's interesting that Edge memorialized it in such a way in U2 by U2, because this was the second single off the album. They had recorded the Las Vegas show the first night of the tour. For ABC, they were promoting the heck out of, you know, ABC is pop, special U2 tour special, and it ran in the 10 o'clock hour the night after Vegas, so they had a very tight turnaround to get the final editing done. So they were going to use this to promote their next single, which is Staring at the Sun. Well, the nerves must have gotten to them, because when the band started playing it, on the B stage, it was so bad because they were out of time, out of sync, out of tune, that Bono just stopped the whole thing, explained that we're having a little row over here. Talk amongst yourselves, and they regrouped and they sped through the track just to get it finished. And in the end, they couldn't use it for the ABC program. So there goes your prime promotion of your second single. But that really didn't matter anyway, because the pop special on ABC ended up being one of the worst rated programs ABC has ever aired. They didn't miss out on much.
Yeah. I remember watching that. You mentioned Dennis Hopper too. He was part of that. Like, it was kind of this, like,
yes, he was.
He was introducing stuff, and then the band was, they were showing clips or, yeah, it was a weird kind of, yeah, just didn't play well on back in the home TV land anyways. That's for sure. All right, let's keep on going. Last Night on Earth.
Feels the ground is giving way.
So I know the song is called Last Night on Earth, and I don't know, for me, the initial response is kind of like, oh, it's maybe apocalyptic, or maybe the person who's living the song is going to die. But I've always thought this was more of kind of U2's science fiction song, where it's not her last night on Earth because she's going to die. It's her last night on Earth because she's going to take off in a rocket ship. When you listen to the song and the effects they use and just the feeling of fatigue and just the way she describes, the way Bono describes the song, for me, yeah, it's always felt more like just kind of a kitschy sci-fi U2 song rather than some apocalyptic, despondent song about someone going to nowhere.
Which it could be maybe column A, column B too, because this is the video with Charles Bukowski, was it? It has a very weird vibe to the driver on her.
Sci-fi where there's like people melting into goo, and if I remember correctly, there's some like lasers shooting and stuff like that. It is more sci-fi than end of the world-ish.
Yeah. Bukowski also had The Last Night of the Earth poems, which I don't know if the song itself was inspired by it or not.
Well, wasn't he on that Pop Mart special? Because I remember I watched it as I was getting into U2, and that's the one part I still remember him reciting some poems in the middle of it.
I think he might have done the Thanksgiving poem for the Zoo TV tour.
Gotcha.
Was that Bukowski?
Couldn't tell you.
It's way too late.
Someone can send comments in if they want to correct us on anything that we're doing here. But I think that I was going to just say to Ian, to your point, the line that's in the, I forget if it's the bridge exactly or wherever, but she'll be dead soon, then she'll sleep, kind of points to the fact that maybe it is death of some sort. But mm-hmm. You could be, I mean, it's not worth debating how literally we should take a lyric by Bono. But I agree with you too. It is kind of a bit of like,
oh no,
are we going off this planet somewhere, or is it like we're the whole planet's shutting down and we're ending it all, throwing it all away kind of thing. So
the Thanksgiving prayer was William S. Burroughs.
Oh, there you
go. Gotcha.
All right. So save that email, folks, for the next one. I was just going to say, I forgot to mention at BTCCU2_U2 said, in my opinion, Staring at the Sun is the best song of the album. At the first time, I didn't like pop, but now I really like it. And then at U2 War 40 for Last Night on Earth said, the end of Last Night on Earth live is absolutely U2 kicking. Are we allowed to say?
Took us.
Arse. That's Arse. The U.S. approved. Censor approved version of a donkey. Anyways. All right. Before we're really gone, let's keep going.
I've taken steps that make you feel dizzy. And then you answer it when you feel.
Speaking of gone, this is a track that took different meaning once Michael Hutchence passed away. Mm-hmm. He, Bono in concert would yell out to Hutch, Hutch, before just diving into Gone. And it was at that point when he really put so much emotion into the performance that for me it overrode the album version, but it's such a once again it's another one of those heavy tracks that just make you feel the pit of your stomach, and it's a thinker.
Yeah, and just in the chat room, Spice asked, "Who's Hutch?" And it's Michael Hutchinson. Hutchins is a former lead singer of INXS, Australian band, who killed himself, committed suicide, or died in 97, yeah. Is why. I looking at U2.com on this album, or the song anyways, on their own database, and I should check a cross-reference at U2's just to make sure it's accurate. But the last time they performed this is 2001, which it feels like the song they would have, like I think Marilyn, you were saying earlier, like feels like a song they would have performed more recently than that. Marilyn, do you have some Gone comments?
Yeah, I think this song, I think this is a big F you to everybody, from Bono to everyone. I think I can feel some kind of frustration in these lyrics from him. Maybe he's tired of defending himself. Maybe he's, sick of having to explain himself and what the band is doing. And I think especially this song is just like, screw you guys, we're gonna make the music we want to make, we don't care about what you think. And like Sherry said, I think there's a lot going on within all these songs. I think there's so many layers, but I always look at this like, sort of a start of a fight. like if you want to challenge me, go ahead. I'm already gone. You know, like go ahead and challenge me. I'm done with you. I'm gone.
It's really funny that he's saying, you know, you can keep this suit of lights. And what was he wearing during the 360 tour at the start of the encore, either during Hold Me, Thrill Me or Ultraviolet? He was wearing a suit of lights.
Yeah.
You know,
another missed opportunity. They definitely should have done this song during that tour.
Tasula mentioned the charm best song on the album. And this is another one, I think, if I remember, I forgot to listen to the single version, or it's the version that's on the best of, or there's I forget whether it was a single version and the best of version, or one of the, anyways, that has like a reworked, slightly re-edited version of the song, anyways, that is more in line with the live version, right? Ian, you can correct me if I'm off.
Yeah, there were two different redone versions of it. The single version, which I think is better, and then the best of version had that kind of piano intro. And right. That's one of the things that I do really like about the song, the contrast between the slow kind of almost plodding rhythm section and the kind of graceful but slow piano bit. And then you contrast it with Edge's kind of like almost shrill, constantly working at your nerves guitar. And when people say, I mean, when you said, yeah, it's about Bono just saying, screw y'all, I'm tired of this. It is that contrast between the desire to keep on moving forward, the slow general push forward, and then Edge's just that constant irritation, always picking at the back of your head with his high-pitched guitar. It's a really good contrast song, I think.
It's also a tie to Staring at the Sun. You know, at the end of Gone, he's saying, you know, I'll be up with the sun. Are you still mm-hmm. holding on? I'm not coming down. A couple songs prior, he was staring at the sun. He wanted to go blind. He wanted to be up in the sky. And it's a pretty quick transition if you're looking at lyrical storytelling, that what he was dreaming about a couple songs later, you know, that's where he wants to be, and that's where he is.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at Last Night on Earth, he has that line where he references the two British tabloids, but it also works in that mm-hmm. I guess three sun structure where it's. She's at the bus stop with the news of the world and the sun, here it comes. It's
right.
Got that awesome tabloid tie-in, the Beatles reference, and it says that the sun is coming. And next song, he's off with the sun.
Mm-hmm. But is it S-O-N or S-U-N? That's for you to figure out. Is it the second coming?
Right.
With the apocalypse and all that other stuff. Ooh.
Yeah, it does make for a good trilogy that way of, like Ian said, and it's one that, like, I was going to say before is that I think I'd love to hear how, if they could, or what it would sound like anyways, for like an acoustic version of Gone, similar to Staring at the Sun, and in that it's not an obvious, like it does have, like you said, that sort of shrill guitar and bass, but anyways, I could totally hear some sort of acoustic version of it, maybe just like annoying coffeehouse version, or I don't know, we'll see, but something for the At U2 cover band to work on someday. All right, let's keep on going south down to Miami.
Photo shoot. Fresh man, squeaky clean, she takes glory.
Poor Adam. Some of Adam's best bass lines are in some of U2's worst songs.
I'll just throw in At U2 War 40 mentioned Miami has one of Adam's best bass lines that easily defeats Bono yelling Miami over and over.
It's true. I know there's a lot of songs on this album that get a lot of flack, but I can find little nuggets of goodness in every song on this album, and that for me is the little nugget of goodness, is Adam's beautiful bass line.
Yeah, I think I what I find in this one, I love that too, and then also just the, again, I keep like the swagger that U2 has, or Bono, I guess if you want to look at it that way, in the lyric, and kind of just the way his playfulness and like Ian reference, just kind of, there's a lot of smart stuff. I mean, there's some really kind of cheesy throwaway lyrics in it as well, but just kind of the fun he's having with lyric. It's not, you know, Akatung Baby One kind of lyrics all the time or whatever by any means, especially in Miami. But yeah, the sort of fun they're having with the music, it didn't necessarily pan out commercially, but it seems like a lot of fun. And at Stu Likes Drums mentioned, which is maybe why he doesn't like this song, he said, "Who is responsible for Miami making the cut as an album song? Worst song on the album for me." Which I love, just the, again, the dichotomy and the extremes that U2 fans go to.
So two things. I would say the line, "We can make something beautiful, something that wouldn't be a problem." I think that line in and of itself redeems the entire song. It's just so like sleazy and sweaty and kind of gross. And I can just see someone in Miami saying that so clearly. And for me, it just makes the song. But then secondly, earlier there was a reference, "Where's the chest hair?" This song is like chest hair turned into music. It is just that gross and sweaty and just kind of peeking over the like unbuttoned shirt. And that is what this song is.
I cannot get Allen Ginsberg's reading out of my head on this. Just after the Kmart album launch, MTV followed U2 around for the day or two, and they ended up on a rooftop in New York somewhere, where Allen Ginsberg was sat outside wearing his winter coat and winter hat, reciting the lyrics to Miami. And there's just something about Allen Ginsberg saying "my mammy."
Okay. That was the thing I was referring to earlier. My mistake. It wasn't on the Pop Mart special. That was the thing I was remembering. Okay. Thank you for clarifying it for me.
Yeah. I was going to say love that line too, Ian. "We can make something beautiful, something that wouldn't be a problem." And then that's a beautiful little phrase, and then the next phrasing of, you know, "Some places are like your auntie, but there's no place like Miami," is just like, oh, so
crazy. They were trying to find a word to rhyme with Miami.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on. Although we'll see.
Again, one of the more maligned songs on the record, but I kind of like this song. There are a lot of throwaway lyrics on the song, but there's that beautiful little bridge near the end that redeems the whole song for me, where he says, "Then there will be no time for sorrow, then there will be no time for shame." And I just love that. I don't know what it is about that section of the song. But then also Edge and that kind of slide guitar thing he does, it's awesome.
Yeah, there's another one that's probably like you'd say, you know, Adam's bass line even too, and here it gets kind of is lost in a otherwise fairly throwaway song. And at Bruner Caffey mentioned on Twitter, "I never got why everybody hated Playboy Mansion. It's a nice little song with great harmonies, odd gem in the U2 catalog," which, yeah, I would agree with. I think, is U2's site accurate in that it's never been played live? Is that
correct?
That's true. So why, yeah, it doesn't get up there with Acrobat in the requests for some reason.
I'd rather hear this than Acrobat.
There you go. Send Marilyn the hate mail. Go ahead, Ian. Sorry.
For me, this song commits one of like the cardinal sins in U2's catalog, in that it dates itself. Like when you listen to it now, it's like OJ is More Than a Drink, Michael Jackson is History. I think they've only done it with two other songs. They did it with Seconds, where he runs his like USSR DDR and then Peking. And then he does it in Kite, where it's Last of the Rock Stars when hip hop played the when hip hop drove the big cars. And for me, it just grates so much, just because it is very much of a specific era and a specific point in time. It's not kind of all expansive like pretty much all of their other songs are. And yeah, for me, yeah, can't forgive it. Can't forgive it.
Well, and this track also had a little bit of a controversy, in that, if you look at the album art very, very, very carefully, and you look at Larry's green tinting and the shadowing, you'll see in his eye, if you tilt it to the side, it almost resembles precisely the Playboy Bunny.
Whoa.
And so when the album was first released, knowing that there was a track on it called The Playboy Mansion, there was talk in fan circles that there might be something more to it, given that Larry's eye has the Playboy Bunny in it. Now, I don't think that Hef ever tried suing you two on it, but it was one of those little hidden Easter eggy kinds of things, linking the track with the album art.
I was going to say that's some Larry folks just staring too long at Larry's eyes, I think, but sorry, go ahead, Ian.
I was just going to say, once you see Larry's bunny eye, you can never unsee it. It's there every single time you see it.
Yeah.
He's got a little rabbit in his eye.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you can continue to debate that one, but all right, let's move on to If You Wear That Velvet Dress.
It's a daylight that gets me through the beat here before. Last time you scratched at my door.
I'll say first of all that there's a version with Jules on the Jules Holland Show, or from Jules Holland, I forget where it was, but the Jules Holland album, Best of Friends, featuring Bono and his band, full band, doing this song, if you haven't heard, is worth tracking down and taking a listen to. And I think for me, this song is just like it is like a bit of a lost gem in that it's a U2 at their sort of slinkiest, and I don't know if it's sleazy or not. It's certainly, yeah, in the ballpark of that. But I didn't know what to make of it as a song, but hearing the sort of other versions they've used it in since then, and like I said, the Jules Holland version, kind of reignited the song as an interesting song to listen to. But anybody else with Velvet Dress thoughts?
I've always thought this song was almost kind of like ethereal, kind of phantasmal. Like it's not really about like people. It's about more like kind of platonic concepts. It's just, it's so seductive and so kind of just happening in the middle of like a glowing, almost undescribable night. For me, it kind of goes beyond just like human concepts of like seduction or like lust or whatever. It's yeah, just kind of more this like platonic ideal of a seductive song.
Yeah, it's that interesting phrasing, looking at it again, of we've been here before, last time you scratched at my door, the moon was naked and cold, I was like a two-year-old who just wanted more.
Yeah.
It's kind of,
yeah.
It's like, I don't usually, you know, the kids don't, yeah, anyway. Kind of just puts your head in this weird space, but go ahead, Mary.
I'm going to disagree with both of you men.
You go, Marilyn, you go.
Seriously, this is not a sleazy song, and it is not platonic in any way, shape, or form.
I never said it was sleazy. I think it's a beautiful song.
Chris said it was sleazy.
Yeah, she's disagreeing with both of us collectively.
I'm disagreeing with you both, okay? This is a very sexy song, and I think most women who listen to pop will probably skip over the rest of it just to get to the song. And I actually need to go take a cold shower now after listening to it. I adore this song because I feel like Bono is doing his best imitation of Frank Sinatra, like the crooner.
Yeah.
And I think he pulls it off really well. I think it's just a really beautiful song. It's a quiet song, and the picture of Larry in the booklet on that page just adds to my feeling about this song. I mean, Everybody go get your little booklet out of your CD.
Just make sure you take a cold shower if you're going to go take a shower.
Yes, yes.
It encouraged too many ladies to wear velvet dresses to the concerts.
Maybe too
and
many.
He would and he would pull them out of the audience to sing to during this when it was part of the B stage encore. But I was always captured by the very last verse about tonight the moon is a mirror ball. So it sort of ties back to discotheque. Light flickers from across the hall, but it's this line, who'll catch the star when it falls. If you think about Bono being the star, when he finally falls off of his pedestal, who's going to catch him? So I've always looked at this song as a very personal song for Allie.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and I'll definitely just maybe I'll just edit out my comments. The chat room is saying things like unbearable, exploding hotness. Yes, yes. Pull me up on stage and roll around. So it was. In fairness to me, I was put on the spot. Becky is not here. She was supposed to take the lead. I'm sure she would have had something equally interesting to say.
Wait, Chris, are you wearing a velvet dress right now?
Maybe. And that's why I haven't snapped any pictures of. All right.
The two other things I would say, I think the bridge is one of the most, again, like to tie in with all, If God Will Send His Angels, the bridge is one of the most beautiful things you two have ever done. Just hearing that, like chiming, as Bono says, that silver end of the guitar that Edge finds, and just Adam's bass rumbling underneath it. It is just so beautiful. And then the other question is, what does Bono whisper at the start of it? Because it sounds kind of dirty.
I'm sure Marilyn is listening very closely.
To know and you to find out.
Yeah.
I think he says something different to every person that hears it.
Larry's my favorite.
So how do you, bearing all that in mind, I guess, how do you segue from that into Please properly? Because it feels like quite a juxtaposition of songs. But anyways, we'll try to do that right now.
Just peel off the Band-Aid.
Yeah. Splinters like rain, you could only feel your own pain.
You're going from the lust of If You Wear That Velvet Dress into the reality of Please. The fact that the song begins with, so you never knew love until you crossed the line of grace. So that juxtaposition that transition from the one song into this one is right there in those first two lines of the track. You wake up the next morning and you realize, what have I done? This is one of the pivotal songs that U2 has ever made. It takes Sunday Bloody Sunday, takes the anger of Sunday Bloody Sunday, and it presents a very mature argument to why there needs to be peace. It's no longer saying, you know, how long to sing this song. It's just, you know, it's not necessarily begging, but it's like, you guys have got to get it together. We've got to find this common ground. And there's no way to do it because you still have that little bit of resentment, that little bit of anger in there, you know. So you never knew how low you'd stoop, and the Catholics and the Protestants and this and that. When this song was released as a single, you had the four key politicians in the artwork for it, and it was one of the driving forces for that Good Friday agreement in when was it, in 1998. So this is taking all of that history and just pouring it into roughly a 5-minute track. When it was performed live, it was powerful.
Yeah, U2 War 40 mentioned "Please Is a Great Prayer," but "The Troubles" is the best song. Is it the best song to segue into "Streets," which certainly was definitely on that tour. And again, if for whatever reason you haven't found yourself to picking up a copy of the Pop Heart Live EP, definitely worth grabbing just for that very reason. "Please" going into "Where the Streets Have No Name," and then it also has two songs from the. My first U2 show, which was the Pop Mart show in Edmonton in 97. But yeah, for me, this song is both like there's a political and the, like we've said many times already on this episode of U2, but then musically as well, it's kind of to me like, now hear me out. It's a little bit like Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven or Guns N' Roses' November Rain, where it's like this song that builds to something and has this massive outro. And sort of one of U2's songs like that in their catalog that they can do, and is Edge as literally on fire as Bono has proclaimed many times, but actually is on this song, and just the I love all the melodies and guitar lines floating throughout this song, and the band as a whole coming together. It's the one, definitely the song on this album that I go back to time and again, regardless of whatever mood I'm in, especially noodling around on a guitar or something like that, and trying to, it works great as acoustic version as well, and it's fun to play that way and sort of hear it. Not that I don't think U2's ever done an acoustic version of it, but
they did do that stripped down version after 9/11 on the Elevation tour. For me, yeah, just two things come to mind. It's another example of where the single version was so much better than the album version. And secondly, there's just a series of lines in this song that truly convince me that, I mean, anybody who liked Doubt's pop just needs to just look at the song again. And Bono is truly one of the greatest rock lyricists in history. Just these lines. "So love is hard and love is tough, but love is not what you're thinking of. Mm-hmm. Love is big. It's bigger than us, but love is not what you're thinking of. It's what lovers deal. It's what lovers steal. You know, I found it hard to receive because you, my love, I could never believe." Just what he does with that. It gives me goosebumps, honestly.
And the video is very emotional.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I feel like the lyrics, he's really just calling you out. You know what I mean? You know, like, oh, please, like, get up off your knees. Like, that kind of whatever it is that you're doing is not appreciated.
False humility. You know what I
mean? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, very cool. All right, well, let's go on to the final song on the album, Wake Up Dead Man.
So I wrote a little bit about this song and off the record a few months ago about how it's one of kind of U2's dark corners, along with songs like Corpse. And the thing that they had in common was the Edge's heavy involvement in the song. Evidently, he wrote a lot of the song, wrote a lot of the lyrics in the song. And just the way Bono's voice, the effect that's put on it, it makes it sound like it's in such a contained, claustrophobic space, like a crypt or a coffin or something like that. It's the song where, I mean, they have that little hint of the F-bomb in Mofo, but this is the only song where they've ever dropped a full-on F-bomb. But I can't imagine a more appropriate place for it. And then you have I think it, what was it? I think it was Romanian or Bulgarian, folk songs in the background. Just that's the wailing that you hear behind the main lyrics of the song. It's so angry and so sad and so trapped and so kind of despondent. And what I really, really find fascinating is this is the song they finish up pop with, just this horrible, trapped, contained, like miserable little song. And then the song they open up All That You Can't Leave Behind with, the next album song that comes after this, is this massive, expansive, beautiful day. And just the contrast, those two bookends. I love it. I love it.
It's as if Bono found Prozac.
Exactly. Exactly. Or he got out of the coffin and finally got a bit of sun again.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Got out of the discotheque. And
Yeah.
It's one that I feel like it works in terms of, the, like you sort of described the scenery of it almost, and the production works in that sense. But it, as just a standalone song, it feels like it suffers from overproduction and over, because there's a very beautiful song in there that, given, you know, even the if you would wear the velvet dress kind of style production, it could work really well. Not copying it exactly, but just that style, it could work really well as well. And especially just the lyric and the sort of sultry Bono, the way he sings it almost through this, but yeah, muffled, kind of like you said, coffin sounding or whatever. And it, like I said, it works in terms of the album, and is a great way, I think, artistically to end the album with that style of production. But just in terms of as a song, it feels like it gets lost in it a bit. And a better song on its own, anyways, was there to be found. But we'll have to wait. But
what's
day.
Also interesting is the EPK, the electronic press kit that was released to preview Pop prior to it coming out. They featured Discotheque at the beginning, and then there was this really wacky, wonky transition, and the rest of the EPK is Wake Up Dead Man. Was it a good choice to sell the album? Probably not. It just felt very weird to use a good chunk of this track to promote the new U2 release, you know. And it doesn't sound very poppy, you know. Once again, just like Octung Baby, it's a silly sounding title for a really heavy album. It carries over with this particular one. The line, "Listen as hope and peace try to rhyme, listen over marching bands playing out their time." You would have the Orange Day Parade or the St. Patrick's Day Parade, where you would have the religious factions playing their marching bands, going through the streets, and that memory of mine from back in 93 when I was in Glasgow for a college trip, and I witnessed the Orange Day Parade and the marching bands. I'm thrown right back there about, you know, Bono's singing about, you know, we need help here. We need, peace. We need, you know, once again, God, where are you? This whole album is screaming out, God, where are you? You're not in anywhere I'm looking for. Where are you?
And then referring back to Octung Baby, this was one of the lines from my favorite of the Octung Baby outtakes, where I don't know the song ever had an official title, but you could see where it was going to become the fly and lady with the spinning head. Mm-hmm. And partway through the song, Edge just starts singing, wake up, dead man, and just keeps on repeating that in
right.
one of the choruses. And then I think Wake Up Dead Man was one of the lyrics or one of the song titles that was hidden in Zuropa's Static on the back of the cover, along with mm-hmm. "If God Will Send His Angels" and "Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me." So you could see it was a concept that had been with them and Edge in particular for a long while before it finally showed up on Pop.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you would love to hear, you know, like you said, that version, but like just the actual genesis of the moment, or the, not the genesis, the moment, the spark, I guess, when it finally was like, okay, now it's ready to be on an album, and sort of the that process of going for many years in the sort of, let's keep trying and banging away at this one until we can figure out something to use it for or whatever. And all right, well, in what was I was thinking was going to be a shorter episode has gone hour and a half almost. So I'm changing. Matt, I'm going to just filter any emails I get from you. Just go to spam. So don't bother letting me know how long it was. We had fun talking about pop. Quickly going around the round table here at BTCC_U2 says, which is your favorite pop song? So we're going to go quickly. Marilyn, what's your favorite pop song? Song for pop.
My favorite song from pop is Please.
Hey, Sherry?
Mofo.
And Ian?
Mofo, not even a contest.
Mine would be Please. So, and then Kevin at Kevin STU said, rank pop as a U2 album, and is Pop Mart the most significant tour playing Sarajevo, Cape Town, and Johannesburg, and the most countries ever? Both great questions, and something that we will, I think we'll use some of those kind of ideas for either our wrap-up discussion maybe of everything, or maybe when we just talk tours. I don't know. We have a few different ideas for future episodes, so we'll follow
U2's most underrated album.
There you go. Probably can say that. So yeah, coming up next, now that we've popped pop, I don't know what that means. All That You Can't Leave Behind is the next album that we'll be discussing, and we'll be doing that here. And we record this live. If you want to tune in, sometimes usually we record live goodstuff.fm/live is where we record it. And you can find past episodes at goodstuff.fm/ATU2. You can follow the U2 crew on Twitter at ATU2 and facebook.com/atu2com. Folks around the round table here, where can folks find you? Let's start with you, Sherry.
At U2com, Sherry, as always.
And Ian?
At Ian P. Ryan.
And Marilyn?
At Miss Marilyn.
And I'm iChris, and thank you to at Simon Peta for the theme music that you're hearing as we exit the show. And hope you enjoyed our episode on pop. And like I always do after every one of these episodes, go back and re-listen to the songs and the singles, and kind of gets me back in the mood for listening to that era or that album of U2. And always, as we said, be sure to comment or send us a comment or tweet using the hashtag AskAtU2, and we'll be sure to include you in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Bye.